Welcome to Beach Books and Beyond with me, Monique Chambers. Each week, I invite a different guest from a different walk of life to talk to me about books that they've read, which have influenced them, and books they suggest we take to the beach this summer. You've no excuse not to be well read. Welcome to this week's edition of Beach Books and Beyond with me, Monique Chambers, and my guest this week is Brandon Shaw. Now, Brandon, you're going to speak and we're going to immediately notice that you have an American accent.
Yes.
Why did you come to Malta?
I came to Malta. I work at the university. I'm a lecturer in the dance studies department.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So that's how I got over here. I was living in Providence, Rhode Island before I came here, which is the smallest, I believe it is the smallest state in the U.S., so it was in some ways transferable.
So is Malta obviously much bigger than Rhode Island, at least?
It's not bigger than Rhode Island, no. It's probably a quarter the size of Rhode Island, I believe.
Oh.
So for a state, Rhode Island is small, but it's still larger than Manhattan. Sorry, than Malta. Yeah. No, I was thinking about this comparison between Manhattan and Malta, and I believe Manhattan is even bigger than Malta, as I recall.
Wow.
So, yeah.
That makes us feel kind of big, small.
Big, small, yeah.
So you transferred over to the University of Malta how long ago?
About 3.5 years ago. I came in 2014.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so as a dance teacher, essentially, what types of people do you teach? What sort of dance do you teach?
My training is in contemporary dance primarily, but I had a kind of parallel dance history with a lot of tango. I'd done Argentine tango for a long time.
Oh, okay.
Yes, and contact improvisation and salsa. I'd done ballet sort of further back in my history. So, yeah, but my interest primarily with dance is largely with partnering in general. That's kind of the thing I'm more interested in than sort of solo works and then kind of getting people together to make them go fast or to make big structures and stuff like that as well.
So do you translate the books you read into dance, or is there some of that involved?
I don't translate necessarily books I'm reading into dance, but I would say that what I'm reading very much informs my dancing, and sometimes my dancing informs what I read. So one of the books which I didn't bring that I was really influenced by was a book called Structure, How Things Stand Up. And it's an architectural book, but it also looks through, through history. So they look at the pyramids and basically how there's evidence that they played with different angles for the pyramids to try to find the one that would let them go the highest without compromising the structural integrity of the buildings themselves. And so that kind of stuff is interesting to me, not in terms of architecture, but in terms of bodies. How do you sort of get bodies and put them on top of each other? And maybe, you know, this idea of columns with roofs on top is not the best way to look at it. Maybe we should look at different sorts of architectural approaches.
Okay. And so the pile of books you have got here, I don't recognize a single title. So that's a first for me.
Okay.
So I'm going to let you do all the work, which is wonderful. Start us from the top.
Start us from the top.
Origin of Satan.
The Origin of Satan. Yes. Always first. This is a book that I got sort of captivated by the idea of Satan, of the sort of Christian Satan, the Christian devil. And I think out of a sense of sympathy for the devil. This was related to a piece that I had made called Sticks and Stones, where it was sort of a David and Goliath story. And I was, you know, in some ways it's easy to pitch that good against bad, but I was very sort of captivated by this idea of the devil helping the weaker, you know. And so I started doing a little bit of kind of poking around and came across this book by Aline Pagels called The Origin of Satan. And her interest is in how sort of the Satan figure grew within the biblical corpus. It started off sort of as an adversary a bit, but sort of who was a sort of like God's bad cop or something like that.
Okay.
And then, you know, became more of a sort of metaphysical entity of tempting and making evil. And then by the time we get into, you know, full-fledged Christianity, then they say, well, you know, the Jews were possessed by the devils, or the heretics were possessed by the devils. And so this process of demonizing somebody who disagrees with you took on import over time. But I think it's also interesting that the devil does everything that God can't do. So you have to sort of explain the existence of evil within God's paradise. And so, well, it can't be God's fault. So you kind of have to come up with this idea of a devil in order to make God seem clean. So the devil ends up being sort of the scapegoat for everything within the God machine that doesn't make sense.
Does tango fall into that?
Does tango? Well, certainly in the sense that tango is considered a devil's art. You know, and this is dance in general over time has been sort of vilified as being, you know, this form that tempts people away from virtue, from the church, from all these sorts of things. It's bodily, it's sensuous, it's everything, you know, that's bad. And, you know, even before the tango, is actually the waltz, which was considered this dance that was very, very demonic because the people were facing each other while they were dancing. They were spinning around too fast. There's a anti-dance treatise called From the Ballroom to Hell, which is about how basically waltzing can cause women to become addicted to waltz. They fall in love with their teachers and then become pregnant and then cast out and become prostitutes. And so very quick,
yes.
quick step for the preacher who wrote the text. But yeah.
That's the origin of Satan. So that's, yeah.
Yes. That's the one. Okay. If we're just going completely in.
Okay. Well, we can, they're just so unusual titles. The all new Don't Think of an Elephant.
Yes.
Where does that come into play after Satan?
This is a book written by George Lakoff, who's a cognitive linguist, if I understand correctly. And he's very interested in this idea of framing. So basically, the way that you pitch something, the sorts of words that you use or that you don't use,
okay.
Very much color how something is taken. And so the idea of don't think of an elephant is as soon as you've said elephant, you can't not think of an elephant.
Mm.
But he puts this in terms of, I mean, he's a progressive himself, but he's basically saying, you know, why is it that if progressives are often better educated than conservatives in the U.S. at least, why are we losing so much? Why are we getting our butts kicked? And he says, well, basically, conservatives have been very, very good at sort of framing debates. You know, so it's, are you pro-life or do you want to have infanticide or something like that? So the sorts of either ors that these are put inside, you know, it's not global warming, it's climate change, these sorts of things. And so basically, if you can get there first and frame the debate, then you're always putting the other person in a position where they have to sort of debate within your own terms.
Your parameters, huh?
Yeah.
Okay. And what subjects did you find in there that you remembered that stuck with you?
I mean, I would say, you know, those two are a couple that stick out, you know, in terms of abortion, in terms also of taxes was something else they said, you know. How do you think of taxes? Do you think of taxes as, you know, the government taking what's yours? Or do you think of it as something like, you know, a membership fee to be a part of the country? Or
okay.
is it a way of, you know, so he's basically trying to give, you know, if you think about somebody who pays a lot of money, who has a lot of money, who might pay a lot of money to go golf, you know, why not say, well, would you pay a lot of money to have roads to drive on so you can get to the golf course and so forth? So it's basically trying to find some shared points of agreement with which you can debate with people who are sometimes very hard to debate with.
Mm.
And before Rhode Island, I'm from Alabama. And our Thanksgiving conversations at home are quite livid or interesting, I guess I should say, because I have some family members who are very, very conservative and I'm very, very not conservative. And so, yeah, I think it's in part, you know, a way to try to find a way of having an actual discussion with people who you really disagree with instead of just yelling at each other.
No, I definitely have to read that one, and I know a few people should read that one.
No, it's good. If we could actually debate and talk about the topics, you know, instead of just quoting bumper stickers to each other, then, you know,
yeah.
I'm happy to talk with somebody I disagree with. I love to, you know, but I want to actually have a discourse with them, not just sort of screaming at each other.
Yeah, no, that would be nice. So either be educated or at least listen to somebody else's point of view and work your way back from there. So is that the last book you read, or is that something you'd read a while ago?
It's not, no, and I haven't finished it. These are all books I haven't finished.
Perfect.
The last book that I've read is this one called Striking Beauty by Barry Allen, and its subtitle is A Philosophical Look at the Asian Martial Arts.
It's a beautiful cover, actually.
It really is, yeah.
Really.
For those of you who can't see, it has a man sort of jumping in the air and kicking with this nice long line and a straight leg.
I was noticing the shirtless top.
And
you
he's
see,
topless,
that's
right? as well,
the muscle.
That's right. Ripped. Yeah.
Mm.
But it does kind of bring up a couple of points. I mean, one of them is that unlike, you know, Western ideas of the body, you know, if you think about bodybuilders and often boxers, but not always, but a lot of, you know, guys who spend a lot of time in the gym, it's all about getting bigger and bulkier muscles. But you almost never see that with Asian martial artists because they don't train that sort of bulky repetition over time. But the idea is that you should be able to move and be flexible along with the speed that you have. And that muscle, particularly the way that you train muscles in gyms, you know, where you want to focus on the resistance, actually makes you move very slowly. Mm. And for martial art, you want to be moving through and having a sense of flow. And so it's the opposite of, you know, grunting under a weight for a long period of time. And the other thing, you know, within this image is also the straight leg. And this is something which we could, you know, talk about a bit as well. The Western aesthetics that sort of come out of the balletic tradition tend to really want to see a straight line.
Okay.
You know, you think of these developes with straight legs up in the air. Everything's, you know, straight lines or slightly bent. In the terms of martial art, that's quite dangerous because it exposes the joint.
Okay.
A locked joint, you can sort of break quite easily.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, the more that you extend your arm, the sort of, if you're reaching for an opponent, then the better chance you have of actually getting your opponent. So there's a form of kung fu called long fist kung fu, which actually does want to really extend the reach and has all these kicks that sort of fly out and stuff like that. But actually, martially, that's a bit frowned upon because you really make yourself quite vulnerable. So if we could sort of, you know, put it in terms of an equation, you might say the more aesthetic, the more dangerous in terms of martial practice.
Okay. The only martial art move I know, I'm going to have to refer to my childhood or teen favorite movie, which was Karate Kid.
Karate Kid, the crane,
you know,
technique.
The crane, that, yes. That was beautiful.
It
that
is.
That's quite something I would like to have mastered at some point in my time.
Yeah.
Is that a real move, though, do you think?
That jumping snap kick is a move.
Okay.
I don't know if the arms in the air crane thing itself. But,
you do martial arts. You sound very...
I do,
okay,
yeah.
You sound very knowledgeable.
Yeah, I've trained a long time.
Yeah.
I've always been dancing and doing martial arts,
mm-hmm.
although sometimes it would be more one than the other. Sometimes I would just be dancing, and sometimes I would just primarily be doing martial arts. But I find that they really feed into each other a lot. And I would say that my dancing is very, very influenced by my martial arts background in terms of training and discipline, but also the kinds of stuff that I'm interested in presenting.
The flow and the movements and those things.
Certainly. And the sense of what you get in martial arts is really, really going for it hard as you can, but also really protecting your partner.
Oh.
And that both of those are important. You know, my Tai Chi master used to say, if you break your partner, you don't get a new one. But the idea is that, you know, you have to be careful for each other. Or in Aikido, there's this principle of respecting each other's ki. You know, you need to sort of meet the person where they are. Ultimately, you know, most of us who are training martial arts are doing it, you know, for self-defense if that needs to be. But in the meantime, a sense of self-cultivation and self-improvement, it takes on a sort of a therapeutic aspect as well.
Did you dance first or do martial arts first?
I did martial arts first, mm-hmm. yeah. And I was rather flexible already, but sort of became more flexible through doing martial arts. And my sister was training in ballet, and her ballet teacher saw me sort of stretching or something like that. She's like, we have to get you in ballet class. So I started doing ballet at that time.
Fair enough.
And they sort of helped balance each other out because people wanted to beat me up, you know, for being sissy and doing ballet,
uh-huh.
but I also did martial arts.
So
it was kind of yeah.
That must have been quite cool to see, actually, you know, go on, try me.
Yeah, it was, yeah. I had a large friend, like the toughest guy in school was my best friend, so that helped as well. So I actually... made it through without having to fight too much, which is the first lesson of martial arts. Don't get in a fight.
So if any of your other reading this year, are any of the others influenced by martial arts or dance, or are they all other stories?
Yeah, so there's also this book, The Art of War, which I brought Machiavelli's, but I actually meant to bring Lao Tzu's Art of War, and they're actually quite different mentalities. Tzu's Art of War is very much about sort of viewing that the master sees the order and how to sort of make something out of the chaos of war. But the person who's not the master only sees chaos.
Mm.
So it's very much about sort of acknowledging the chaos aspect of war and in a Taoist sense, what are you going to do with this? Versus much of the sort of strategic books in the Western tradition afterwards want to say, how can you use strategy in order not to have chaos? You know, so that's... I don't know, as somebody who's trained more in Chinese martial arts, I want to sort of embrace the chaos and sort of say, okay, if that's the actual situation of a fight or of war, you know, how can you sort of acknowledge that and go with that rather than trying to make it the way that you want it to be so that you can win?
Mm. Yeah, I didn't know if I'd go the other way because you want to, you know, when there is chaos all around you, to just keep level-headed and so
yes.
just know, like, yes, it looks like chaos to you because you don't understand.
Exactly.
That actually these things are happening. And so,
exactly. Yeah, that's the, you know, the principle of kind of finding the, you know, riding the wave or kind of, you know, finding the thing, or that's, you know, the Tao. What is the way? There are many things that are sort of happening around you, but how can you find a balance? How can you sort of let these things not distract you, but actually be things that propel you forward.
And the differences in the book, what do you find from the two authors?
Machiavelli's is Machiavellian. He's great. You know, he really, it's mercenary. It's a bit, you know, less, I don't know. I mean, for both of these, there's debate about how much either of them was actually engaged in warfare or how much of it's sort of like an idealistic representation of what a general might do or what would be great to do. But Machiavelli, I mean, it's interesting because you certainly don't want to deal with people who are from this mindset, but unfortunately most of us do, you know, so it's kind of good to sort of know what's coming at you, this idea of, you know, dividing and conquering or throwing in chaos into a machine and so forth. I mean, you see folks doing these sorts of things, but it's not the way I want to live my life. It's not really the way I want my circle around me to be. And so, you know, in part, it's something of a defense mechanism to, if that's the right word, but to see what's happening around you and how you can best deal with it. I mean, I would say that part of this reading, as I'm kind of looking at it, comes out of a desire for social and political engagement, you know, to really sort of see how, you know, the ideals that I hold dear, you know, they're often getting beaten down by people with lots of money, you know, or people with lots of power, people with lots of this and that. And so my reading and thinking is, you know, actually gravitated more towards ways to encounter that, sabotage it, you know, what sometimes you might have to, you know, fight quite hard. Sometimes it might be considered dirty. Sometimes it might be a lot of things, but they're doing the same, you know. So if we're sort of in a situation where we have to sort of fight for migrants' rights, fight for women's rights, fight against racism, you know, address egregious acts of homophobia and things like that, you know, I don't know, sometimes virtue doesn't get you through, I'm afraid.
A lot of the time, unfortunately, like you say. You've mentioned racism there, and you actually have a book titled Racism as well.
Yes. This is by George Fredrickson, and it's a history of the idea of racism. One thing is sort of dispelling the idea that racism has always been with us. Mm-hmm. And he sort of ties it to, really it's a 20th century phenomenon, racism as we know it. And racism being this idea of tying certain ways of behavior to someone's DNA via their phenotypes. So being able to look at someone and tell, you know, because this person has this kind of a nose or because they have this skin color pigmentation and so forth, therefore they must be like this, you know. And this is, you know, for a number of reasons, wasn't really something people thought about, you know, until around the 20th century. And then historically, he's looking at it primarily as European attitudes towards Jews, which did take, has been around for a long time, but the specific tying to race, the way that it's understood now, you know, is, he would say, a 20th century phenomenon. And then going back to ideas of racism, particularly within America, sort of against Black Americans, that, yeah, this is, again, a rather recent phenomenon, I guess, and my thought now, it actually does predate the 20th century as far as the way he's talking about it. But yeah, it's a historical review. And I think it's important to sort of view this as being, you know, in terms of race and racism in general, you know, not sort of just, or maybe even not even primarily individually held beliefs, but these are sort of systematic approaches towards subjection of certain peoples that is premeditated and systematic and, you know, large scale. So although we, you know, we do need to be looking at racist attitudes within ourselves and addressing it sort of as we see this happening among individuals around us, there are very large things at work as well that need to be sort of tackled.
Yes, okay. Yeah. And good place to start by reading this.
It is, yeah. It's a short-ish book for the topic. It's, you know, around 150 pages. Mm-hmm. And it's a wonderful historical work. He doesn't, you know, go much into theories, and sometimes I wish that he would address that a bit more, but primarily he's tackling this as a historian. Mm. In terms of theory, I really like Omi and Wynant, W-I-N-A-N-T. Their book is called Racism in America, I believe it is. Sorry, I don't have it in front of me right now, but that's a great source that also looks at it sociologically and through some theoretical references as well. So that's a great book too.
So read the two. And so you're from Alabama, you were saying.
I am.
So that probably was part of your growing up.
It was, yeah. I was always very adamant against sort of racism just from an early age. And yeah, my best friend, the guy who took up for me all the time, was Black himself. And so I think that was, you know, always kept an impression on me that this was, you know, my friend. And, you know, we encountered it among ourselves. I mean, I think it's a sad thing, but it's true that when he was spending the night at my house for the first time, his mom called my mom and said, you know, Michelle, I just want to be sure that you know that, that Eric's black.
Oh.
Yeah, and the fact that she felt like she had to do to protect her son, you know, and she's like, yeah, we know Eric, we love him, he's come over, you know, blah, blah, and it was, it's fine, you know, but it's a sad reality, you know, yeah, so that could sort of segue.
Yeah, I was just saying, talk about perfect.
another book. I mean,
This I want to start singing to, you know.
Yeah. So the next book is called Funk, The Music, the People, and the Rhythm of the One. And so that idea of the one, I think, is important for funk music. And that has to do, it goes back to James Brown. You know, the one is the heavy beat. So you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 1. So the hard one,
yeah.
Right, that hits down. And this is the soul of funk, according to Ricky Vincent, the author of it. And I think he's, you know, I would really agree with him there. And then he sort of traces this, I mean, has a bit of a evolutionary view of funk, I'd say. Starting with around James Brown and sort of experimentations that are happening there, and then really culminating in Parliament Funkadelic, George Clinton, these guys from the 70s who ended up making, you know, this huge band of sometimes 70 people. And, you know, people today might not have heard of P-Funk necessarily, but they would know certain songs because they get sampled a lot. So I guess if you know Dr. Dre's Chronic, for example, the sort of keyboard work that's going on there is from P-Funk. There are hundreds and thousands of songs that are probably sampled P-Funk, but I can't pull them all up right now. I'm sure they'll come to me a bit later. But, you know, I do think that a lot of the books here have to do with sort of self-education. And I think as an American and as anybody who loves music, like, we all stand very much sort of in debt to African culture. Ideas of ethnicity, the sorts of chords that we find in jazz that have sort of bled out into gospel music, the use of the banjo, the use of the guitar at all. You know, this is obviously African instrument that came to the Western world via the U.S. through slaves and so forth. And I think it's about acknowledgement and giving respect and, you know, props to where things came from.
Okay, and so the book, it covers the key people within the industry and things like that as well. And talks about evolution, you said? So.
Yeah, and by evolution, I guess I'd also meant that it sort of culminates in P-Funk, but he thinks that there's people who sort of took it away from what P-Funk was doing. I mean, his view Vincent's view of funk is that it's positive, that it's egalitarian, that it, you know, celebrates the party, but sort of not as being something where you get strung out, but sort of something that brings a community together and so forth. And so he would look at people like, you know, the gangster rap movement, for example, as being something that really took in a bad direction elements of funk, or even Prince, who I love dearly. He looks at sort of misogynistic aspects of Prince, at the sort of me-centeredness of Prince versus the idea of P-Funk's a group and a collective and so forth, as being a derivation from the spirit of funk. So nobody's going to say Prince isn't funky, but they might say, you know, the directions he took funk were out of the spirit of funk.
The philosophy of funk sort of thing,
Never
really thought of it like that, actually. So.
Yeah, no, it's a great book because he's just so invested in it. And it's, I think it's his only book, and it came out of his master's thesis, and it's super well-researched, and it's almost 400 pages long.
It's quite chunky.
Yeah, and he goes through, you know, all sorts of stuff, Aretha Franklin, Ray Charles, I mean, everybody. It's great historical work, and we'll put you in touch with all the stuff that, for, you know, one reason or another, it might have been very influential at the time. But kind of fell out of circulation, like the bands like the Meters. People don't know so much today, but like they were it in the 70s.
Their time. So yeah. When you were reading it, do you go through and like, oh, now I must listen to that?
I made a Spotify playlist for stuff that I didn't know.
It would take ages to go through it.
Definitely. And the other thing I should probably say about that is I play bass guitar, and I play a lot of funk, and that was kind of a reason for getting into the book as well, that it was, in terms of bass music, in terms of bass guitar, like Larry Graham is the person who people really look back to, and he was the bassist with Sly and the Family Stone, and the whole slapping and popping and stuff that we associate with bass today, he's accredited with it. He's, you know, that's a bit of a dicey history, but certainly he was one of the first people to be sort of putting the rhythmicity of the drums in the bass guitar itself, so to give it sort of melody and rhythm at the same time.
Yeah.
And he was all about the one.
The one.
Yeah.
It's a different one, but yeah, the one.
The one, yeah.
So just moving swiftly on from that, you've got another book, Black Dance in London, 1730 to 1850. I do wonder sometimes how people discover these niche topics to be able to go off and write about.
Yeah.
Not a massively thick book, but...
It's not, but it's really... I don't think books should be thick. I'm a big fan of like the 150, 200-page mm-hmm. book.
Read in an afternoon type of...
Yeah, mm-hmm. There's something to be said for economy. but this is just a research area of mine. I'm interested in sort of Africana dance forms, particularly within North America, and how these preserved African dance traits and African cultural ideas, and how these can be found, you know, within dances that we see today. I mean, a lot of hip hop dances.
Mm-hmm.
And so things you might think about just in terms of isolations or, you know, use of the hips, certainly the rhythmicity, the...
I don't know, what contrabeat would you call that?
Yeah,
the sort of that
or you know, people talk about either rhythmicity in terms of like really emphasizing rhythm more than the melody, but also having, you know, multiple rhythms going on at the same time. So somebody might be doing, you know, a 4-4 with the feet and then doing a 3-4 with the hips mm-hmm. and then something else with the torso. But basically you sort of have this orchestra that's going on within you, and you have these multiple rhythms happening at the same time. Yeah, so that's quite interesting for me. And also, to circle back a bit, this idea of angularity versus straight lines.
Okay.
So one way we can really sort of talk about a divide between European dances and a lot of other forms, but certainly Africana dance forms, is that Africana dance forms really love this angularity, you know, bent elbows and sharp lines and stuff like that.
I'm dancing at the desk here. Right. Just to...
You're missing it. It's great.
Yeah, I have my African trousers on.
Oh, yeah.
So there you go. But no, I can, when you start to talk about these things, you think about, because some things you just take for granted, you know, you sort of walk through life without actually noticing stuff.
Yeah.
And, but yeah, obviously your area of interest. We've got just 1 minute left to talk about your last book.
The last book, Going Out with a Bang. This book is called Making Sex, Body and Gender from the Greeks to Freud
mm-hmm.
By Thomas Lecour. And it's a really fascinating look primarily at ideas of sex within the Renaissance. And mm-hmm. to sort of be brief about it, the idea was that, you know, if we, Renaissance viewed women as being not fully formed men, and if they were fully formed, then the vaginas would drop and turn into penises and so forth.
Okay.
And you know, in the same way that we would see a flower, that when it blooms, it becomes something else. And so
mm-hmm.
The anatomical drawings during that period would represent women basically in any way they could as being not fully formed men. Now, if that's the case, then there's much more of a continuum between sexuality, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not male or female. It's female could have been male or something like that. And so the lines between the two actually becomes much more porous in ways that are more friendly to sort of the ways that we're thinking about gender now, as opposed to sort of strict ideas of male or female in terms of sexes.
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting one to finish on.
Yeah.
I'd like to thank you, Brandon Shaw.
Thank you.
You've been talking to me, Monique Chambers, on this week's Beach, Books and Beyond.
Thanks.
Thank you for joining me, Monique Chambers, on this week's Beach, Books and Beyond. I'd also like to thank Samuel Attard and Carmelo Greff for helping me to produce this program. Join us again next week for Beach, Books and Beyond, here on Campus FM.